Okay, so let's unpack this. We are immediately wading into a story that sits, well, uncomfortably between this really compelling, almost mythological urban legend and the bleak, unsettling evidence of a cold, hard forensic investigation.
Absolutely.
The narrative that really captured the public imagination, the one you hear about online, called the subject of our deep dive, the real-life Iron Man.
And that name, that moniker, while it's sensational, it's exactly what we need to dismantle here today.
Right.
We're here to critique that myth, that sort of spectacular idea, against the actual physical record left behind by Elias Kore. This was back in 1982 when his body was discovered. And this isn't a story about, high-tech suits or repulsor rays or any kind of traditional heroism at all. It's a deep dive, a really terrifying one, into radical self-imposed survival.
The core idea, the hook that keeps this story circulating, it's really provocative. He didn't build a suit, he became one.
Exactly.
And the legend pulls you in because it suggests this transformation, so agonizing, so complete, that the line between, well, man and material just vanished. But when you actually look at the source material, the forensic reports, those diagrams, the sheer amount of, frankly, rust involved the word suit feels way too glamorous, doesn't it? Too clean for what Elias Kore actually did to himself.
Precisely. Too clean is exactly right. Our objective today is really to move past that sensational title and analyze the physical evidence. We're talking diagrams, personal artifacts, Kore left behind, very haunting stuff.
Okay.
His modified body, his apartment, they serve as the ultimate sort of silent testimony to a methodology that was entirely focused on achieving physical endurance, not fame, not heroism. We're trying to find the logic, maybe, underneath the madness.
So who was this person, this Elias Kore, before the medal, before this transformation took hold? We know the basics about him at the time of discovery, early 80s, 54 years old.
Yeah, 54. And crucially, he worked the night shift at a local metal recycling plant.
Okay, that detail feels pretty important.
It's foundational. It provides the immediate, undeniable context for the materials he used. Where else would he get them?
Right.
Beyond that job, his personal profile is, well, it's starkly minimalist. The sources say he lived completely alone, no known family, no real social connections we can find, and no prior criminal record.
Huh.
He was effectively an invisible man, someone whose routine just let him blend into the shadows, really, until he disappeared. And then, well, then they found him. And this incredible, almost impossible transformation came to light.
An invisible man who somehow felt he needed to make himself indestructible. It speaks to some kind of deep internal fear, doesn't it? Something he wasn't sharing.
That seems likely, yes.
Okay, let's jump straight into section one then. Let's talk about the Kore record, the literal anatomy of this forced metamorphosis.
Right. To understand the reality, we really have to dive straight into the forensic evidence.
Yeah.
We need to strip away that Iron Man legend immediately.
Okay.
When Kore's body was found, the initial assumption, and frankly, it's understandable, among the first responders, the investigators, was that he'd been a victim of some kind of brutal, maybe sadistic crime,
Yeah.
torture, mutilation, something like that.
Which makes sense, given what they must have seen initially. But the autopsy, which, the source material describes it in pretty grim detail, that shifted the perspective quickly, didn't it?
It did dramatically.
Because they didn't find, like, shrapnel from an explosion
Yeah.
or typical defense wounds. They found, you said, parts.
Parts, exactly. They found materials, bits of metal that had clearly been inserted deliberately, not, violently blasted into the body from outside.
Wow, yeah.
The reality came out when the examiners began the internal procedures. The metal they found inside him wasn't incidental, it wasn't accidental. It represented precise, deliberate internal reinforcement.
Reinforcement.
Yeah,
Yeah.
we're talking about specific hardware, not just used to patch up damage, but to actually structurally modify his skeleton, his muscles, almost like he was anticipating stress, future stress.
Let's focus on the specifics here for a second, because that contrast between the fictional Iron Man's, advanced alloys and Kore's scrap metal, it's huge. We have image one, which shows some of these internal modifications. The forensic experts found specific metal plates behind his ribs. That's not patching an injury, is it? That sounds like foundational structural work, like building something inside.
And the placement is absolutely key. Why the ribs?
Yeah.
It points to an immediate, almost visceral goal,
Yeah.
protecting the vital organs in the chest cavity, the lungs, the heart, the major arteries, safeguarding them from direct impact, blunt force trauma.
So he was trying to make his core structure immune to shock.
That's how it looks, yeah. If you approach it purely as an engineering problem, Given his likely limitations, the conclusion seems pretty clear. He was trying to make his chest cavity into a kind of fortress, using what he had.
Okay, here's where maybe the mythologist in me pushes back a bit on the pure methodologist view. If it was truly meticulous engineering, why these materials? The sources describe crude steel, often rusted. If the goal is ultimate survival, why take on that immense, terrifying risk? Sepsis, tetanus, chronic infection, all implied by using raw, unsterilized scrap. Doesn't that suggest maybe a degree of, well, frenzied delusion alongside the methodology?
That's the tragedy, isn't it? The tragedy of Kor's very unique engineering problem. His resources were incredibly limited. Limited to what he could scavenge, likely from the recycling plant where he worked. All that industrial detritus.
Right, the connection to the plant again?
Exactly. The infection, the crude technique, those are almost the unavoidable side effects. He's a self-surgeon operating without antiseptic knowledge, without sophisticated alloys. He seems to have chosen density, brute strength, over sterile function. It was a trade-off.
A terrible trade-off. Beyond the plates behind the ribs, you mentioned other reinforcements.
Yes. There were steel bands found around his forearms, acting almost like primitive fused gauntlets, protecting the radius and ulna, the bones you need for lifting, striking, or just warding off a blow.
So armoring the limbs, too.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps the most telling detail, at least from a biomechanical perspective, there was a rusted hinge fused directly to the back of one of his knees.
A rusted hinge?
Yeah.
On the knee joint. Okay, that detail is just, it's horrifying, but also profoundly fascinating to me.
It is.
It implies not just crude reinforcement, but a deliberate, probably agonized trade-off. Was he trying to fix an old injury, maybe? Or was he intentionally sacrificing the fluidity of movement, the natural bend of the knee, for a new kind of rigid durability?
The evidence suggests the latter. A hinge, especially a rusted one, fixed like that, it severely compromises the natural rotation and flexibility of the knee. You wouldn't be able to bend it properly.
No.
So it looks like Kor made a conscious choice. He exchanged smooth articulation, natural movement, for stability and load-bearing capacity. He was sacrificing long-term mobility, the ability to run easily, or even walk without pain, probably for immediate, extreme rigidity. Rigidity needed, perhaps, to withstand crushing force. It's a literal manifestation of survival at absolutely any cost.
And the overall condition of the body, it painted this unspeakably brutal picture, according to the sources, described as a work of scars. Ragged, often discolored, clearly infected in places.
Yes, the integration wasn't clean.
And the methods used to secure the flesh around the metal. Rudimentary, desperate. Some cuts apparently held shut with wire, like makeshift sutures. Others just left open around the inserted metal, letting the materials integrate with the flesh as best they could. Horrifying.
This harsh reality, though, it immediately clarified that initial interpretation of torture. The idea that someone had done this to him was quickly overruled.
How so?
The sheer volume of metal, the specific placement, the nature of the objects, combined with the complete lack of clean surgical technique, it all pointed overwhelmingly to self-modification.
Oh, okay.
This wasn't an external attack. This looked like a methodology, an internal radical survival strategy driven by desperation, using the materials he had easy access to from the recycling plant.
Yeah, this is where that mythological interpretation really grabs hold, isn't it? This is the ultimate expression of the body as armor theme, but stripped of any Hollywood glamour. It's not the sleek, polished suit of Tony Stark. It's raw steel, rust, maybe copper wire. This transformation wasn't a technological marvel. It was a literal, agonizing fusion of man and material, driven by some solitary dark necessity we're still trying to understand.
It's the self-made machine, isn't it? Built from the inside out, piece by painful piece. He seems to have rejected the limits of organic biology, the fragility of bone and flesh, and chose to replace them, or at least augment them, with the resilience, the density, the blunt resistance of scrap metal.
He was trying to become heavy, anchored, difficult to dismantle.
That seems to be the goal, yes. Sheer immobile density.
We really have to frame that contrast for you, the listener. The high-tech image of Iron Man is all about seamless integration, AI, flight, power projection. Kor's reality was jagged edges, constant pain being grounded and centered on creating density. It speaks to this profound solitary dedication to just enduring a perceived threat rather than actively combating it in some flashy way.
And this is where we absolutely must introduce our first careful hedge, a point of caution. While the physical evidence points very strongly, almost undeniably, towards self-modification, you know, the hardware, where the wounds are, the consistent use of scrap metal, we have to acknowledge that the precise step-by-step chronology of these operations and the full detailed psychological drive behind them, well, that remains an inference. It's based purely on the artifacts we have.
So we're reverse engineering a mindset from its physical results.
Exactly. We're interpreting the what to understand the why, but the why is still somewhat speculative.
An interpretation based not just on the body, though.
Yeah.
But also on the tools and, crucially, the blueprints. Which leads us perfectly into section two, the methodology, the environment where this transformation actually happened.
Right. If Kor's body was the final agonizing product, then his apartment, that was the dedicated, if makeshift, factory. We need to shift focus now from the internal hardware to the external environment, the place where this transformation happened. And it emphasizes the incredibly methodical, almost obsessive nature of the whole operation.
When you imagine a scene like this, self-surgery, self-modification, you might expect chaos, right? Frantic madness, tools everywhere, blood splattered randomly. But the sources seem to suggest the opposite, a highly ritualized, specific workspace, designed meticulously for self-engineering and, crucially, solitary effort.
That's right. We start with the central working space. It's captured in image two, the workbench. Now, this wasn't tucked away in a garage or a basement workshop like you might expect. Strikingly, it was right there in his kitchen.
In the kitchen. That's odd.
Very odd. And the surface of that workbench was heavily stained, described as being saturated with both oil and blood.
Oil and blood. Wow. That mixture. It speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
About the fusion of his two worlds.
It really does.
The oil represents his job, the recycling plant, the grease, the materials he handled every day. The blood represents his personal obsession, the intimate, messy, life-threatening reality of integrating that same material into his own body.
And the kitchen, typically the most domestic space, becomes this bizarre fusion point. Factory and flesh right there next to the stove, maybe.
Okay, so the location is significant. What about the tools? Were they just scattered around?
No, and this is key. The meticulous arrangement of the tools further reinforces this idea of methodology, challenging that initial assumption of pure madness. They weren't strewn about in panic. According to investigators, they were laid out like surgical instruments.
Like surgical instruments, industrial
yep.
tools.
Yes. Things like grinders, clamps, maybe crude cutting implements, but arranged with the kind of precision you'd expect from a surgeon preparing for a complex operation. This suggests careful planning, phased operations, perhaps, not just a single frantic act.
That detail, the arrangement, it actively argues against the idea of sudden panic-driven action, doesn't it? Mm. It implies Kor studied this. He planned. He waited for the right moment for each modification.
It certainly looks that way.
Treating his own flesh, horrifyingly, with the same methodical approach he might use to dismantle or repurpose valuable scrap metal at work. The planning seems absolute, even if the execution was, well, brutal.
And the most convincing evidence of premeditation, the blueprints, found in the apartment were apparently dozens of hand-drawn diagrams.
Blueprints, not just sketches.
No, not rough sketches or doodles. These were detailed plans, showing, and this is a direct quote from the sources, bones reimagined as steel.
Wow. Bones reimagined as steel. That phrase. It turns him from maybe just a victim of delusion into a genuine, if tragic, engineer of his own survival.
It does. It provides pretty irrefutable evidence of premeditation. Intent. He intended to create internal load-bearing systems designed specifically to withstand immense impact.
What exactly did these diagrams show? Do they get into specifics?
They did. The diagrams charted the biomechanical changes he intended. They didn't just label where the metal pieces would go. Often they included notations notes on weight distribution, potential stress fractures in the metal or bone, load vectors, how force would travel through his modified body.
So he was really thinking like an engineer.
It appears so. They showed, for example, internal bracing mechanisms designed to maybe shunt force away from the spine or the brainstem, cross sections indicating how those steel bands around the forearms were meant to prevent telescoping fractures under extreme pressure. He was literally charting a new armored future for his own skeleton.
Okay, that level of planning is chilling. Now let's get into the really bizarre spatial setup within the apartment.
Yeah.
Because that confirms the intense difficulty and the sheer isolation of these self-surgeries.
Yes, there are two really striking details here. They're shown in image 3 and 4. It's the combination of ceiling mirrors and a leather strap bolted directly to the floor. This configuration, it tells a harrowing story about the logistics of his transformation, how he actually did this.
The leather strap. bolted to the floor. Hey, that immediately suggests the intense need for stabilization, right? Securing oneself during really difficult procedures. If you're operating on your own leg or trying to drive a metal plate behind your ribs, you'd need immense force or absolute immobility. You'd need to be physically anchored. He was his own assistant and his own restraint system.
A brute force restraint system, yes. And then the mirrors. That, for me, is maybe the most chilling detail of all, because it reflects the profound isolation.
How so?
They imply the absolute need for self-observation, precision. During operations that required impossible angles, think about the physical challenge. Installing metal plates behind your own ribs or fixing a hinge to the back of your knee. You need to be able to see around corners of your own body. You'd need this sophisticated three-dimensional reflective perspective just to guide your hands.
It underscores the intense, lonely, incredibly dangerous labor involved, performing complex, high-risk procedures completely alone, relying only on mirrors and these crude, absolute restraints. It's hard to even imagine the pain, the concentration, the sheer terror of knowing there was no safety net. One slip, and that's it.
So the interpretation of the process seems unambiguous. The apartment wasn't just his home. It became this makeshift, dedicated laboratory for self-preservation. It reflects an almost obsessive application of self-engineering. Every tool, every piece of hardware scavenged, every vantage point offered by those mirrors, it was all calculated to advance his physical modification.
He took the chaos of industrial scrap, the stuff from the recycling plant, and applied this meticulous, agonizing order to it, transforming it into a personalized internal defense system. The methodology wasn't just about the tools, it was the process of survival itself, ritualized and executed in absolute secret. Okay, we've analyzed the body, the physical result, and we've looked at the workshop, the environment. In Section 3, we have to move inside the final, maybe most opaque frontier, the mind of Elias Kor. We need to explore the interior world of this man using his own written words to try and finally understand the motivation. Why do this? Why such a radical, agonizing transformation?
The physical record is incredibly compelling, of course, but the journals, they provide the necessary psychological context, or at least clues to it. Without his written words, we might just assume generalized madness, maybe clinical delusion. But the journals seem to point to a very specific, singular focus, a focus that ties directly back to his need for that structural reinforcement we talked about.
Let's focus first on that repeated mantra. This line was found written multiple times throughout his journal, almost like a prayer, or maybe an oath he took. If I can survive, so can you.
That phrase, it captures the core theme of his efforts almost immediately, doesn't it? It seems to override any concept of heroism or fame or rescuing others.
Yeah, it's not outward looking at all.
No. Kor's purpose wasn't public service or glory. It seems to have been purely personal endurance, but framed as some kind of universal truth. If I can, you can. That phrase feels less like a plea for help and more like a chilling declaration, a manifesto almost, for extreme, painful resilience in the face of, well, something. Collapse, maybe.
I kind of see it as a form of self-instruction, too. Like a psychological reinforcement mechanism he needed to justify the trauma he was inflicting on himself.
That's possible.
By saying, if I can survive this agony, then you, maybe meaning his future self, or maybe anyone facing something similar, you can too. He was universalizing his very specific agonizing actions, elevating his excruciating process from just a personal obsession to maybe a necessary rational philosophy dictated by some terrible circumstance.
But then the narrative shifts quite dramatically. It moves from that general survival philosophy to an immediate, very focused threat. This comes from the final note found taped alongside the journal. And that note, it elevates the stakes profoundly. It makes the armor seem reactive, not just proactive.
Reactive. Okay, what did the final note say?
The final note read, "He's coming for me. You'll need this."
Wow. Okay. "He's coming for me. You'll need this." That suggests the armor, the modifications. They weren't prepared for just general chaos or some existential dread. Mm-hmm. They were for a specific, imminent, anticipated confrontation.
It certainly seems that way.
The transformation wasn't just adaptation. It sounds like urgent, reactive defense against an identified enemy. Someone specific.
And this specific threat appears to be tied directly to the only visual evidence we have of Kor's fear. This mysterious, singular Polaroid photograph.
Right. Tell us what image 5. The Polaroid, it was found taped inside the journal's back cover, right? Mm. Which suggests it had intense personal significance. It was the focal point for his fear.
Exactly. And the image itself is, well, it's profoundly unsettling, mainly because of its simplicity and ambiguity. It shows a man, but he's blurry, distant, maybe obscured by light or movement. He seems to be watching from across the street. The sources refer to him as the Polaroid Watcher.
Blurry and distant watching.
It's highly ambiguous. We don't know who this Watcher is. We don't even know if he was truly menacing or just some random person Kaur fixated on. But its careful placement, taped inside the journal, that provides the immediate specific catalyst, at least in Kaur's mind, for his radical actions.
That blurry quality. It almost reinforces the paranoia, doesn't it? The distance underscores that feeling of being hunted, observed from afar. And the fact that it was taped into his most private record, his journal, seems to confirm that this Watcher, real or imagined, was the absolute catalyst for this extreme self-engineering project. The armor was built for this one, singular adversary.
The methodologist in me synthesizes the specific note he's coming for me, and this visual evidence, the Polaroid. The fear seems concrete to Kaur, and the self-armor was intended as a direct, proactive defense mechanism against this perceived external threat.
So, the recycling plant worker wasn't building a costume to fight crime, like the legend implied.
No. He was constructing protection against a single defined enemy who he believed, rightly or wrongly, was closing in on him.
And that specific, grounded, terrifying fear, that's what separates him so fundamentally from the fictional Iron Man, isn't it? Stark builds armor to project power, to fight external foes all over the world. Kaur builds armor to absorb force, to endure a personal, immediate threat. His objective was purely defensive, stemming from that immediate, looming sense of dread represented by the Watcher.
And we can draw a crucial contextual insight here. Thinking back to other records we've analyzed in different contexts, this phenomenon, it kind of echoes a principle we sometimes see, maybe like with the fictional Klaus Richter case we discussed once, where the deliberate act of erasure or disappearance, or in this case, radical transformation, becomes the most compelling evidence of the threat itself.
Ah, okay. Right? So Kaur's physical transformation, the artifacts he left behind, the armor, the tools, the diagrams, they become the only tangible record we have of the reality, or at least the perceived reality that he faced.
Precisely. The armor itself becomes the witness to the threat. If the Watcher was real, Kaur built his own record of that struggle directly into his body, piece by painful piece.
And if the Watcher wasn't real, if it was delusion,
then the sheer power of that delusion was enough to necessitate this agonizing, ironclad response. The perceived reality was just as potent as objective reality in driving his actions.
Which leads us, I assume, to our second necessary hedge, focusing on the ambiguous nature of this catalyst.
Exactly. This is important. We cannot ascertain the identity or even the objective reality of the figure in the Polaroid. We just can't know for sure who that was or what their intentions were, or even if they existed outside Kaur's mind. Its significance lies purely in its role as a motivator for Kaur's radical self-modification.
So whether the Watcher was an actual person posing a threat, or just an imagined foe, or maybe a manifestation of profound paranoia, the effect on Kaur was exactly the same.
Correct. The need for armor, for transformation, was perceived by him as absolute and immediate. That perception drove everything.
That's a really crucial distinction for you, the listener, to grasp. The subjective reality of the threat, Kaur's certainty of a coming confrontation, dictated the objective reality of the transformation. His mind convinced his body that only steel would suffice.
Mm.
Okay, now, in our final synthesis, section 4, we really need to summarize the distance. The huge gap morally, practically, between that public legend, the real-life Iron Man, and the dark, solitary methodology of Elias Kaur that the evidence reveals.
The gap is vast, absolutely, and it's defined primarily by motivation. Why did he do it?
Yeah.
The legend calls him Iron Man because the resulting figure, you know, a man integrated with metal, it equates so neatly with popular fantasy, wish fulfillment almost. The media, the public, they love a superhero comparison. It's a high concept, this idea of transcending human limits.
But the record, the actual evidence we've just walked through, it reveals this profound, disturbing divergence in purpose. Kaur earned the name, maybe because he literally turned himself into metal, but crucially, not to save the world, but to survive it. That's the key difference.
Exactly. The myth is defined by power, projection, maybe even altruism in the fictional version. The reality of Elias Kaur is defined entirely by necessity, internalization, and pure, desperate self-preservation.
So the legacy he left behind is not one of heroism. What is it then?
It's a legacy of applied, agonizing necessity. Those plates behind the ribs, the steel bands on the forearms, that rusted hinge on the knee, the meticulously drawn diagrams. These aren't relics of madness, necessarily. They're documented physical steps. Steps in a single-minded process of self-engineering aimed entirely at endurance. Rigidity, resistance, just lasting longer.
What stands out above all else after reviewing all this It's that profound, desperate belief he must have held. The conviction that the human body, just as it is in its natural organic state, was utterly insufficient. Insufficient for whatever ordeal he believed was coming.
Yes. He seems to have concluded that only radical modification, only the agonizing introduction of non-biological density and strength, could possibly prepare him for the confrontation he feared. Whether that confrontation was ultimately internal, a product of his own mind, or external, embodied by that watcher, he felt unprepared.
And the metal. That was his chosen medium for adaptation, extracted directly from his working life.
He was taking the strongest, most resilient material available in his immediate environment, the scrap metal he handled every single night at the plant, and using it to reinforce what he perceived as the weakest element in his defense. His own fragile organic body, he was literally trying to weld his destiny, locking himself into a state of likely perpetual agony.
Such a dark, solitary testament to, well, to human resilience, I suppose. But twisted, he didn't seek to transcend humanity by becoming a god or a hero. He just sought to fortify it. Through painful, isolated, methodical effort, reducing his capacity for life, maybe, in exchange for a perceived capacity to endure death.
So, we exit this deep dive, hopefully having acquired a deeper understanding of the extreme, self-imposed measures one individual took. Someone focused entirely on extending his physical capacity, his sheer endurance in the face of an unknown, possibly unknowable, terrifying threat. This is survival theory pushed way past any normal breaking point.
Kor's story is definitively not a traditional hero's arc. There's no triumph here in the conventional sense, no victory over a villain, only this profound, dark reflection on the terrifying lengths an individual might go to ensure their own survival when all other avenues feel exhausted, or maybe were just rejected from the start.
We began this conversation talking about a compelling myth, the real-life Iron Man. But we have to conclude with the factual record. A man who felt he had no choice but to merge with the tools of his trade, paying an unthinkable price for sheer, brutal density.
Elias Kor's transformation. It's a poignant, yes, horrific, yet utterly compelling reminder, isn't it? That sometimes the only way a person perceives they can endure a world they believe is made of metal is to integrate it. Survival reimagined as armor. Not a hero's arc, just a man who tried desperately to outlast a world made of metal.